Phil Fusco made the trip from Lowell, Massachusetts to Campbell in the late 1970s, and by 1985, he had earned both his undergraduate and law degrees. Ever since, he has practiced in the area, but his contributions have gone far beyond his professional pursuits. Raising a family, active in his church, supporting the Campbell Wrestling Program, and starting a nonprofit organization, which was inspired by his late son, to help children all over the world are just a few ways that Phil has stayed busy. My name is Stan Cole, class of 1987, and this is the next installment of Tales from the Creek, where we visit with people who have made this place special over the years. I'm delighted to be joined today by Campbell Wrestling alum Phil Fusco. Welcome to Tales from the Creek, Phil, and thanks for taking the time to visit with us. Phil, let's just start at the beginning. Tell us about growing up at Lowell in the 70s and what your life was like back then.
Well, I grew up in Lowell, Massachusetts, which is actually like a factory town.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in a place called the Moody Street Projects. My father was disabled, and so I wouldn't say it was on the right side of the track, so to speak, but I didn't really have much of an opportunity with regards to school or any of that stuff, actually. And so when I graduated, I was actually going to the SEALs. And with the encouragement of my aunt and my uncle and my cousin, David, who was in the Navy at the time, they convinced me to come down to see them, and they had plans to introduce me to somebody from Campbell Admissions. Now, you know, as far as money is concerned, we didn't have any money. As far as scholarship or academics are concerned, I didn't have any real background. You know, so I just thought it was an impossible task. We had no money. I didn't have the academic background. But my cousin got me here to Campbell in front of an admissions officer here. And he told my story and then asked them if they would give me a chance. And surprisingly, they told me that they would give me one semester. Even though I didn't have the money and I really didn't have the academics as well, they said they'd give me one semester and they'd see how I would do. And if I could prove to them that I was serious about it, then they would give me another one. And so that's sort of how I moved forward in life. Ended up graduating in 1982 with a business degree and specialized in trust management.
Mm-hmm.
And then decided that I was going to go to law school. And went to law school again with the help of Campbell financially. They helped me. And so I went on to law school, and I graduated from law school in 1985. And so here I am. I've been practicing for almost 4 years now here in Dunn in Harner County.
So, Phil, you're a member of the wrestling team. We're here. Did you participate in sports in high school? Did you wrestle or have any experience at that?
Well, you know, I had to work a lot of jobs in Lowell. And so at one point, I decided I wanted to try to wrestle. And I wrestled for several months, but it was just very difficult because of the working and the wrestling. So I had to leave the team.
Sure.
So when I came here, I really had no intentions of doing anything but surviving.
Right.
You know, trying to keep my head above water. And so I had a very good friend. His name, they called him Pluto, Dave Farquharson. He was a 190-pounder in the wrestling team scholarship. And I was asked by him if I would consider joining the wrestling team, walking on. For the first year, I didn't do anything because I was just trying to make it. I think it was my sophomore year that I walked on, and with the encouragement from Pluto, and started wrestling. And wrestled 167 and 177 until I was injured. I dislocated my elbow in the beginning of my senior year. And that put me out for a long time. So it was put me out of wrestling, but it put me out a lot of things for a long time. But in any event, that's sort of how my wrestling career ended.
You said, you mentioned the money, the academics. How did you make the adjustment to college academic rigor, you know, when you got here? How did you...
I mean, it was definitely a challenge. You know, I just really studied constantly. I mean, really constantly. I studied day and night, trying to figure my way through this, you know, this maze of things that I just wasn't used to. I remember when I first got here, you know, I was from Lowell, and Lowell was right there with the ambulance and the fire station and the police station and all these things. And when I got here, it was so quiet, I couldn't even sleep at night. It was just crickets, you know, it was funny. But, you know, I spent a lot of time in the library.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like hours upon hours in the library. And, you know, that's what it took for me to be able to even try to compete.
Did you know you wanted to major in business, or how did you come up on that?
No, I really didn't know I wanted to major in business. I wasn't really sure what my uncle had a little bit of influence there in just telling me that he thought that business was probably a pretty versatile kind of major. And so I just went in with business. And then maybe it was my sophomore year or so, I decided that I was going to move into trust as well.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you had to keep a certain grade point average, I felt like that would force me to continue moving forward with my academics. And so that's what I did.
Who are some of the folks that you remember that helped you along the way or pointed you in the right direction? Some professors, anybody like that in particular that you're...
I remember Dr. Miller is with that. I think I went to school with Jimmy Witherspoon.
Mm-hmm.
And just... Professor Tuck was a real encouragement to me, and many, many others. I mean, I just had some really good professors that really helped me along. And, you know, I just needed that encouragement. I mean, I was here, and it was a very different kind of place, and it was a very different kind of atmosphere. And everybody just really encouraged me. I loved biology. I loved professors there, just everything sort of came into place. I believe it was God's plan, but that's just me. You know, I think that God used Campbell to get me to where he wanted me to start this journey. I mean, he continues to use Campbell to do that with me.
Phil, PJ Smith was the wrestling coach when you were here. What was PJ like to wrestle for? And what was the vibe around the team at that time?
We, you know, today, I mean, the wrestling team today, not that I'm talking down the wrestling team back then, but the wrestling team today is just unbelievable. I mean, as far as their accomplishments, not only locally and around the area, but also nationally,
mm-hmm.
And even internationally, quite frankly.
Sure.
Back then, we were more of sort of ragamuffin kind of guys that came onto the mat. We were given, you know, a singlet and some shoes, and we wrestled over at Carter. We had one single mat and a light up above when we would have a special day. We'd have one wind light down and sort of spotlighted it. And we'd have very few people attending. I mean, you know, but we, you know, we held our own. We wrestled, you know, about not the same kind of wrestling schedule that they have now, but we wrestled a pretty tough schedule. So it was a great experience.
Did your dedication, your work ethic and studying help you in wrestling or vice versa? I mean, wrestling is a very much of a, you know, it, you've got to, you know, manage your weight. You've got to stay disciplined in so many ways. How did that academic athletic balance work for you?
Well, it did actually. You know, I thought when I first went into this, I thought maybe it was going to be too much for me to wrestle and also keep up my academics, but actually it worked the opposite. Because of the rigors of wrestling, it taught me a lot more about discipline.
Mm-hmm.
It also taught me a lot about time management. And I'll be the first to tell you that wrestling really has taught me more life lessons than anything else I can think of. It's taught me a lot about business. It's taught me a lot about trial work. It's taught me a lot about law. I mean, you know, I would never, ever substitute anything for the experience that I had from wrestling here. It was just a bunch of great guys, PJ and Doc, and all of them were there, and it was just a really good experience.
You are in a business with a trust, emphasis, undergrad. What prompted your interest in law? How did that come about, Phil?
Well, one of the things that I did was because of the library, and I was studying in the undergraduate library, and I just decided I wanted a little bit more room. I was studying these little cubicles, you know, so I started going over to the law school, which is Kivett mm-hmm. Hall at that time, and I would go into the law school. I had more room to spread out, and just my life experiences in Lowell and sort of the toughness of what went on there and the police there and everything, just that played a part in deciding that I wanted to proceed in law. But it really didn't seem feasible anyway until, you know, my junior and senior year, when I began to see that my grades may be good enough to do it. And so that's when I really got serious about it. I read a book called 1L on Scott Turow mm-hmm. and his experience in law school at Harvard. And I don't know, it just sort of changed my life. It gave me hope that I could do it.
How was law school different than undergrad for you, Phil?
There was a lot of reading, and there was a lot of intensive study. There was a lot of logic. Not that there wasn't an undergraduate, but in law school, there was this whole method that you had to learn. It was sort of like breaking down everything that you ever learned about, and not only in undergrad, but generally life, and teaching you to think like a lawyer. We began briefing cases and trying to understand the law, and whether it's the black letter law, whether it's the opinions, all the different things that we had to sort of grasp. It was very difficult, but it was very interesting to me.
You were in the first decade of law school graduates, and from the get-go, Campbell had a great reputation of preparing their law students to pass the bar and to pursue careers. What was it about at that time? What was it about the law school at Campbell then and now that makes it so exceptional?
Well, when I went to law school, it was relatively new.
Mm-hmm.
And they recruited professors from all over the United States, from these really good universities, people who were getting ready to retire and they wanted a place to come and to relax and yet still teach and maintain their teaching positions. So many of the professors who I just loved, I mean, many of the professors who were very encouraging, they had a tremendous passion for law. I mean, they didn't just, there was a professor from Notre Dame, there was a professor from Harvard, there was a professor from University of Michigan, some of the greatest law schools around the nation. And they all came here to this little Buies Creek and began to teach the law to us. And it was really a privilege. The whole system was based on Harvard. Mm-hmm. They used the same testing procedures. They used the ticketing system. They used, you know, all these different things. So they really based this whole law school on trying to do it right, like they always do in everything. And so as a result of that, I mean, generally speaking, the bar passing the examination, the bar examination was very high from Campbell at the beginning.
The old joke was that there was nothing else to do in Buies Creek but study.
Study and wrestle. That's true. I mean, you know, it was a big change. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot to do but study. And I mean, we had some social life, but not much.
You graduated from law school in 1985. What prompted you to stay in the area, Phil, rather than to go back home or to a larger place?
Well, first of all, I love North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And I really loved the whole experience here. It was so, it's hard for me to explain to you that it was so different than when I would wake up in the morning and I would step outside and I would see the pine trees and the green grass and the buildings and all the things that went with it. I mean, it was just transformation. I mean, it was just like a whole different thing. So I really fell in love with North Carolina. I met a girl here. She was, she's also a graduate from Campbell Handler. And we started dating. This was when I first started practicing law. She was still in school. We started dating, we fell in love, and eventually we got married. And we decided, she was from Dunn,
mm-hmm.
originally, so we decided that we would settle in Dunn, and that's what we've done. We've been there for a long time.
Our guest today on Tales from the Creek is Campbell wrestling alum Phil Fusco. Phil, in 1991, you and Angela welcomed your son Philip into the family. Tell us a little bit about some of the challenges he faced.
Yeah, well, so he was our firstborn. We have three children, mm-hmm. Philip and Victoria Nicholas. And Philip was born in 1991. And when he was firstborn, there were all kinds of issues. He was born at Duke. Angela had a tremendously difficult time with not only with labor, but even her pregnancy. She was in and out of the hospital quite a bit. And so we really didn't know what was going on. I remember that there was, they did a 3D MRI, or and a sonogram, I'm sorry, not an MRI, but a sonogram. They did a 3D sonogram, and they came to us and they just said, we're not really sure what's wrong, but there is something very wrong. And so they suggested to us that we abort the baby. And of course, we were Christians. We were never going to do that. So we told them that that was absolutely out of the question. He was born at Duke, and there was a 14-hour labor. Angela's temperature spiked to 104. And when Philip was finally born, they put Philip on Angela's chest for about 2 to 3 seconds and then grabbed him off and put him into an incubator and took him off to the intensive care unit, the neonatal intensive care, where we spent the next 4 months really not knowing exactly what was going to happen. After he was in intensive care, and then after some period of time, they said that he just wasn't really progressing like they wanted him to progress, and that those beds were like gold, you know, but they couldn't keep somebody in there that was progressing. So they wanted to put him in the regular, into a regular pediatric ward. And we would just have to stay with him 24 hours a day, one of us. They had a little plastic bed in there and all these alarms that were attached to him. And so we would take turns sleeping in there, and we would be with him constantly during that time. And then one day, Angela was changing his diaper, and she realized he was turning blue, and that he wasn't breathing. And so I ran out and screamed. They came running in. They called the code blue. And there were doctors, nurses, and everybody in there. They ended up telling us, it's time for you to leave. And there was this chaplain who was standing outside the door. She took us to a little room, and she said, I think it's time to pray for your son. And we prayed. I mean, we prayed. And so we prayed until they told us that Philip was alive, but in intensive care again. And, you know, when we went to see him, he was actually worse off than he'd ever been. And, you know, he was tied to tubes, and he was tied to, you know, oxygen tent and just everything that you can imagine. And, you know, Angela couldn't hold him. It took her a long time before she could even hold him. And then now it was really even worse. We didn't know whether he was going to live or die. The doctor came to us and said, the doctors, and they said, look, here's the problem. Philip has this issue, whatever it might be, this issue. And he has very soft tissue. And so his trachea, or his breathing tube, is not developed. So he doesn't have, and then remember the doctor drawing like a tent, like a round caterpillar, you know, like a caterpillar tent. And he said, you know, in a caterpillar tent like this, you have these rings, and those rings are actually what keeps that tent up. So you can crawl through it. Philip doesn't have those rings. So depending on his position, depending on, you know, whatever the situation is, it collapses. And when it collapses, there's no guarantee that it's coming back up. So we're going to have to intubate it. We're going to have to put a trach in. So we really, you know, I had a sort of an issue with that because I had clients that had trachs at a young age. They could never take it out.
Right.
Once that trach went in and it fused, it was too detrimental to take the thing out. So I told the doctor, I said, we want just a night to think about it. And he was a little upset about it. He said, you know, we need to do surgery tomorrow morning. So you better be making that decision. We asked them about a second opinion. They said they didn't do second opinions. So we went down to the chapel that day and we prayed. Like, I don't think like I've ever prayed before. And I just asked God to please, if we did this, to let him survive the surgery and to also let things work so that maybe one day we'll be able to take it out. The next morning, we went to tell the doctors that we were going to approve the surgery since it was dangerous. And the doctor was puzzled, you know, and he just looked like he wasn't sure what to say to me. And then he just said, we redid the testing and the tubes are there. I said, what? He said, we redid the testing and the tubes are there. Never did give me an answer.
Right.
Just told me that we didn't have to have the trach. And we didn't have to have the trach. He never had that issue again. It's just that simple. I mean, you know, I tell people you think of it as you will, but you know, I know inside what it was. And so that let us know right then that, you know, maybe God had some special plan for Philip, that he would take him through all this stuff and still that he would survive and be able to do. Now, it wasn't easy. I'm not saying it was easy. But what I'm saying is that God made a way.
Phil, you know, in our earlier discussions, you mentioned how Philip had to have, you know, multiple surgeries throughout his life or hospital stays, and that had played a part in your decision to choose criminal defense as your specialty.
Well, yeah. So Philip he was really in and out of the hospital most of his life, his young life. There was a very special hospital in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that specialized in product, the only one of its kind in the world. And he would spend 3 or 4 months at a time there. He was in and out of hospitals for surgery. He had a major surgery at UNC. He had a very major surgery at Shriners. He had other surgeries on his ankle. He had, you know, just all different kinds of things that he went through. And I was practicing law, and it was impossible for me to be in Pennsylvania and also be down in court, you know, trying to carry on a daily practice. And so a friend of mine contacted me, and I had been doing some death penalty work, capital defense. And he said, well, you know, why don't you just do it full time? And I said, can I even do that? And he said, well, yeah, the great thing is, you know, you can sit in the hospital room and you can be reading discovery and preparing for your cases. And you're not going to have to be in and out of court all the time. And, you know, I just think it might be a good situation. So I started doing that. And sure enough, I mean, I was able, when Philip went to Shriners for his surgery, you know, I could set up my office right in his room. I'd be sitting with him the whole time. right next to his bed. I'd be able to work right there. If there was an issue, I was always right there to be with him. So, and my wife too. So it really allowed us to be able to do the things that we needed to do and still make some money while we're doing it, you know.
The Fighting Camel Club empowers student athletes to lead with purpose on and off the field. Over the past 3 years, donations to the FCC have helped fund scholarships, facility enhancements, health and wellness improvements, and the greatest needs of the athletics department. With our move to the CAA, the need for your support has never been greater. Memberships begin at just $100 and can get you access to exclusive merchandise and seating. Head to GoCamels.com and hit the Give button.
Phil, you know, the Bible teaches us to look after people who are in prisons, look after people who are unfortunate, to refugees and all sorts, you know, whether it's the Good Samaritan story or how does your faith play into what you do, as a capital defense attorney?
Yeah, well, you know, I always believe that God puts you in places where you can make a difference. And so my philosophy has always been that when I'm appointed to represent somebody in a capital murder case, that I spend a lot of time with them. I get to know them, and lots of times it's situations where they've never been loved before. You know, now don't get me wrong, I'm not talking about excuses here.
Right.
But as a Christian, you know, you look at it as Christ loved us unconditionally. And I just believed that if I could establish a relationship and show them this unconditional love, maybe they would listen. And so it was really, and always is, an amazing experience, because once they feel like you love them, they feel like you care about them, they start wanting to know why. And when they're wanting to know why, there's only one answer to that question, and that's because of Jesus Christ is in my life. And then they start thinking about Jesus Christ being in their life. And it's been remarkable, the number of people I've been able to reach. Genuine, I know, because they didn't really get that much out of it other than,
right,
you know, got everything out of it in being saved, but not necessarily in the criminal realm.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've been very lucky and never had anybody go to death row. So it's in 40 years, I feel pretty good about that. But, you know, it was just God's way of putting somebody someplace where they wouldn't really listen to anybody else. Sometimes you got to reach people with people who, you know, who have lived in certain ways and who, you know, who can touch them.
Phil, share with us, if you will, how the Phillips Love Bears project began.
So, you know, we talk about a little bit about Philip being in and out of hospitals all the time. So he had a condition called kyphosis. Kyphosis is a growing forward of the spinal cord. And if you let that go, it would literally be like a crucifixion. He grows forward to the point where his diaphragm is completely compromised and can't breathe. Well, so back a number of years before, he had this problem, and they did surgery on him at Chapel Hill. And we talked about whether they should use the long rods or the short rods, and they indicated that with the short rods, he would have more mobility. But there was a chance that he would grow over those. You know, these kids are generally short in stature.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we just made the decision that we would go with the short rods so he would have more mobility. Well, he grew over them, and in a terrible way. I mean, he really started being bent over and having difficulty with his breathing. And so we had a connection, or made a connection, with Shriners in Philadelphia, who did all these remarkable surgeries. I mean, they are really remarkable. And we went there, and they said that he needed to have all those rods taken out of his back. And put new rods in. So that's what they did. It was a 14-hour surgery. And he was in intensive care for a long time there. And then when he came home, sometime thereafter, he just said to us, and this was so unlike him, but, you know, he just, when I say unlike him, I mean, he was very mentally and physically challenged, but he just said, you know, is there anything that we can do, to help kids who are hurting? Because, you know, he had experienced that all his life. I mean, he was in the hospital with them, and, you know, he saw the thing, especially in Shriners. I mean, there was a lot, very serious cases.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we talked to him and we talked to each other about, my wife and I, about it. And we decided that we would just buy a little box of teddy bear shells. I don't even know how we came up with it. A little box of teddy bear shells and some stuffing. And then we were going to stuff bears just locally for local people, whether it's the hospitals or the state highway patrol, whatever the situation was. We felt like it would help him because he had a very difficult time with fine motor skills.
Mm-hmm.
He thought it would help him with his fine motor skills and that it would give him self-worth to do something that was helping someone else.
Sure.
And so that's what we started doing. We just got a box of bears, a box of stuffing, and we just, I mean, it was painstaking, but we sat there and we would talk and we would stuff bears and we did a lot of the stuffing, and we would help him do the stuffer. But he loved it. And we finished 37. I remember it was like 37 bears. We had them all lined up on the couch. We still have a picture of him with those bears. And we were going to start giving them to local hospitals. And a church came to us and said, look, we've heard about your bears. You know, and we were wondering whether or not we could take those bears on a missions trip to Belize. We're going down to Belize to build on the playground and to build part of the chapel. And we were wondering if we could take them. I said, sure, take them. Now, that was our first international, the very first. Yeah, that was really the very first thing that we ever did was an international to Belize. And then it just never stopped from there. We started getting into relationships with Ronald McDonald House, International Justice Mission, Johnny Erickson Todden, Johnny and Friends, and on the list goes. I mean, we began getting these relationships with people and started providing these animals to different people around the world. And before you know it, I mean, we were sending bears to the four corners of the earth. We were sending weighted bears. Weighted therapy bears to help with atrophy and also help with psychological mental disorders and also trauma. And also, you know, so what we found was that lots of times people we were dealing with, whether it was International Justice Mission, where these kids had been trafficked, human trafficking, they would get the people, they would rescue the people, the children. And then these bears would serve as this unit of love for them. And it was just something magical about it. It gave them comfort. It gave them courage. And it demonstrated unconditional love. Next thing you know, we were asked to send bears to refugee camps, wars, victims of wars. We would send to the Middle East, or we would send to wherever it was that they were having issues. And then hospitals, cancer units, the weighted bears would serve as something that would help with atrophy when the kids were in the hospital and they were sick. They could play with those bears and it strengthened their muscles. And we were sending unweighted bears, and before you know it, you know, we have sent to, you know, 40 plus countries and tens of thousands.
I was going to ask you, do you have any idea of how many you've
actually? I would have to say somewhere around 30,000 bears that we've sent over the last 11 years.
And here in the last couple of years, your bears have gone into war-torn Ukraine.
Ukraine, we were asked to be involved in a campaign when the Ukraine war started. We sent 1,000 animals to Ukraine, have some pictures that are just talk about touching. And we also were involved in a campaign in Washington, D.C. to make people aware of the fact that Russia had kidnapped 22,000 young people to try to erase their Ukrainian background. They kidnapped them and they put them into foster homes and orphanages in Russia. And so through the Bears, with publicity and the different things we did, and also raising money for the issue, we worked with the Global Empowerment Mission, which is called GEM. We worked with Liev Schreiber, who's an actor and known for Wolverine and other things. That's Blue Check Ukraine. And we worked with another Ukrainian group, Builders Ukraine. And we tried to bring awareness to the people in the United States that this is a real issue. We provided Bears up in Washington, D.C. We provided them not only to the kids, there were several children who had escaped who testified before the United Nations. And they brought the lions with them. There were lions, and we provided all these lions. And they testified, and at that time, it was really the first time that the United Nations had said that they were totally behind whatever was going to happen here. They were going to try to help in every way they can. And so it was that, visited the president, just all different kinds of things going on with it. So,
and you've got a full-time job. You know, and this feels like a full-time mission as well. How do you keep it all together, Phil?
God works it all out.
Right.
We got to the point where we realized, wait a minute, this isn't just sending little boxes of bears to hospitals or to, you know, wherever. This is getting big. So we started recruiting churches, schools, colleges. Campbell has helped many times to stuff our bears. And, you know, we utilize, I'm a wrestler, so I'm a little biased, but we hire some of the wrestlers to come in and work with us in producing bears for sale, that kind of thing. So, you know, this was the only way that we could keep up with the unbelievable demand that we just sent another, I mean, 200 bears to Global Empowerment Mission. So they work all around the world, Haiti and all these earthquakes and, you know, whatever comes about, then they use our bears to help bring courage to the kids.
So if someone wants to get involved and help out, how can they reach you? How can they do that, Phil?
Well, there's two things now. We have never really sold our bears. Okay, we've always given them away. But we've been rethinking that. And so we're going to start selling our bears on Instagram and on Amazon and maybe other platforms as well. So that those people who can afford to buy them can buy them, and it allows us to give bears to those people who can't afford to buy them. So right now we're going to be, for every bear that's bought, there'll be at least one or more bears that will be provided to people who are in need somewhere in the world. And never ending. I mean, and people often say, you know, well, why a bear, you know? But you could give food, you could give clothing, you could do all these different things. Why would you want to give a bear? Well, you know, my answer to that is so many times these nonprofits, Samaritans and other places, they'll provide, in a war-torn place like that, they'll provide food and clothing and water and medicine, and that's fantastic. We walk alongside and we meet the psychological, mental health needs, the bestowing of hope you know. I remember one time where there was the Haitian earthquake, which happened a number of years ago. And there were 300 children that were stranded on the mountain, on a mountain there. They couldn't get anything to them. And so we sent our bears, and we also, I think I might have talked to you about this, but we also hired a mule or two to be able to get those animals and food and water and clothing up to the mountain. So those bears traveled from the Dominican Republic all over, all through all the paths and things that they did to Haiti. And then eventually we got those bears and all the supplies up to the children. They were with their parents, but they were all stranded. And, you know, so I just find that sometimes when food is provided and clothing is provided, I think sometimes the children look at the animals and think that's so much more important than the water or the food. It's not, but they don't get it. You know, they understand that that's what they need is something to love and something to comfort. And that's what we found. I don't know the remedy. I mean, I don't know the whole thing as far as why it works the way it does. I just know the stories are.
So if folks want to help out or find out more about the operation, you can go to phillipslovebears.com and go directly to the website and learn about your mission, learn about how they can help and the places that you're actively involved in that. Phil, I want to circle back just a little bit if we can before we finish up today. The Campbell wrestling team really has strong ties with its alumni. Especially in the last decade, Coach Kerry Colat and Coach Scotty Sentez have really, really made that an important factor. Of course, Jerry Hartman, who followed PJ as the coach, has been in the area the whole time and has always been involved and that link between the years. But what factors do you think makes those alumni ties so strong among the wrestling program members?
Well, you know, I think that as far as my experience is concerned, I wrestled with Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
We were teammates. And then I got injured before he took over the team. But I think there was such a close tie at camp to the team itself.
Mm-hmm.
It was a small school with a developing wrestling team. We had one mission. And, you know, we were going to try to do the best we could under the circumstances. And as that's grown, I think that same camaraderie that was back then, in 1978, 9, all the way through back then, that same camaraderie continues. And then, of course, the coaches who encourage it. And I think the benefit is that, first of all, we get a tremendous amount of enjoyment from being able to be involved with this program. But I think that very similar to what we're doing here, I think that unconditional love, the connection between older wrestlers and younger wrestlers is just some kind of special thing that goes on. And, you know, I can tell you, I have really, really enjoyed my relationship with Scotty Sentis and the coaches. And not only because they've been very involved with the Bears, but just because I've watched this team grow from where we were many years ago to where it is today and where it's going. Mm-hmm. And there's no telling where it's going.
Phil, it's incredibly obvious that you took an opportunity and made the absolute most of it that you got to come to Campbell. What kind of advice would you give to an incoming freshman that's starting their college journey?
Well, I would say never give up on anything. Lots of times things seem like it's dark or it's difficult. And, you know, I don't know if I can make it. I don't know if this is right for me. But I think you always need to have hope. The hope, Campbell has always seemed to help with that hope. They've been there for people that other schools were not there for. I mean, you know, I don't know many situations where they come in and they take somebody who has no academic background and has no financial ability, and to take that person and really give them every opportunity to try to make something of themselves. So I would just tell freshmen coming in, you know, be disciplined, work hard, don't ever get so overwhelmed that you lose sight of the objective, and that is to graduate from this place and to become successful in your life and help others.
And then finally, Phil, can you put into words what Campbell University and this community, how they've impacted your life?
In every way. I mean, I always think to myself, where would I be if it wasn't for Campbell University? This back then it was Campbell College, mm-hmm. and then Campbell Universities. But where would I be if it wasn't for Campbell College, Campbell University? There's no telling. I mean, I have no idea. I know that the opportunities that they gave me, the lessons that I learned, the lessons through the wrestling program, the lessons through academics, and the kindness that they showed me changed my whole life. I mean, I can't really tell you where I would be, but I know I wouldn't be here. And so I would just say, you know, this interview would be worthless if I didn't say that Campbell College and Campbell University has made a difference in so many people's lives that I hope that people understand how important this university is and the things that they actually do.
I'm Stan Cole, and our guest today on Tales from the Creek has been Campbell Wrestling alum Phil Fusco. Thank you, Phil, for sharing your Tales from the Creek.
Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it, Stan.